Picture this. It's a perfect Saturday morning. You made a coffee, you checked the weather, and the first few hours look great. Wind's calm, sky clear, you're going flying today. But by the time you finish your pre-flight, the afternoon breeze has started to build, you look down toward the departure end, and the windsock is doing something. Not straight out, not limp, something in between and angled, and a small voice in the back of your head starts asking the question every pilot knows. Can I handle this? I'm Tower, and this is ATIS on Radio Hangar. Today, we're talking crosswinds. Specifically, we're going to give you a tool you can use on the ramp in your head before you ever key the mic. A way to clock the crosswind and know with a reasonable degree of confidence whether today's conditions are within your limits or outside them. Today's segment is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. These are challenge coins made for pilots by people who understand what it means to earn every step of this pursuit. From your first solo to your airline transport pilot certificate, each coin marks something real. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's talk about crosswinds. Here's what most student pilots learn, and most experienced pilots forget. The maximum demonstrated crosswind component in your pilot's operating handbook is not the same thing as a hard limit. It's the highest crosswind component the test pilot evaluated during certification. Your aircraft may be capable of handling more, or you may not be. And that's the distinction that matters most when you're standing on the ramp making a decision. The Federal Aviation Administration does not mandate a crosswind limit for general aviation aircraft. Your aircraft's manufacturer sets what's called a demonstrated crosswind component. In your Cessna 172, that number is typically around 15 knots. In a Piper Cherokee, similar in some high-performance singles, it's higher. The key word in all of these is demonstrated. It means a test pilot flew the airplane in that crosswind and said, yes, this works. It does not mean the airplane falls out of the sky at 15.1. But here's why that number still matters. If you're a private pilot with 200 hours flying once a month, that demonstrated number is a very reasonable personal ceiling. Because crosswind landings are a skill, they degrade. And they degrade faster than you think, especially if you fly from a field where the runway usually lines up with the prevailing wind and every landing is a non-event. So how do you know, standing on the ramp, what crosswind you're actually looking at? This is where the clock method comes in. Think of your runway heading as 12 o'clock on a clock face. The wind is coming from some direction. Your job is to figure out the angle between that wind direction and the runway you're using. Then estimate what that angle means for your crosswind component. Let's say you're departing runway 36, which is a 360-degree heading, and ATIS is reporting wind from 030 at 18 knots. That's 30 degrees off your runway heading. On the clock face, the wind is sitting at about 1 o'clock. Here's the math shortcut. At 30 degrees of difference, your crosswind component is roughly half the total wind speed. Half of 18 is 9 knots. That's your crosswind, the remainder. About 15 to 16 knots is a headwind component. You've got a good headwind working for you and only 9 knots of crosswind. Manageable for most pilots and most light aircraft. Now change the scenario. Same runway, wind from 070 at 18 knots. That's 70 degrees off heading on your clock face. You're approaching 3 o'clock at 60 degrees of difference. The crosswind component is roughly 87% of total wind speed. At 90 degrees, it's the full wind speed. So at 70 degrees, you're somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 16 knots of crosswind, and your headwind component has shrunk to maybe 6 knots. That changes the picture significantly. The shorthand most pilots use runs like this. 30 degrees off runway, take half the wind speed. 60 degrees off runway, take 87%, 90 degrees off runway. The full wind speed is your crosswind. For angles in between, interpolate, it's not perfectly precise, and a trigonometry professor would wince, but it's close enough to make a sound go or no-go decision on the ramp without pulling out a flight computer. And that's exactly the point. You don't need calculus. You need a fast, reliable estimate that tells you whether the conditions are in your wheelhouse or outside it. Let's connect this to the windsock, because ATIS and AWAS are great, but pilots read windsocks. And a windsock gives you real-time ground-level wind information that the automated weather station a mile off the field might not fully capture. A fully extended windsock indicates winds of approximately 15 knots or more, depending on the sock design. A sock extended to about half its length suggests roughly 7 to 10 knots, and the angle of the sock relative to the runway tells you the crosswind story. If the sock is blowing more or less parallel to the runway, the wind is mostly aligned. If it's blowing at a sharp angle, nearly perpendicular, you're looking at a meaningful crosswind component. Apply the clock method to estimate the angle and run your rough multiplication. One thing worth flagging here. The windsock at the departure end may tell a different story than the one midfield or at the approach end. Surface wind can vary across a single runway. Trees, hangars, terrain features, all of it can create local variation. When conditions are near your limits, get updated information from the tower or AWAS before committing to a plan. The few minutes that takes is worth it. Now, what do you do with that crosswind number once you have it? First, compare it to the demonstrated crosswind component in your pilot's operating handbook. That's your starting reference. Then compare it to your own recent experience. When did you last fly a meaningful crosswind? Meaningful means more than 5 or 6 knots of actual crosswind component, not just a light quartering breeze. If it's been 6 months, your practical crosswind limit as a pilot may be well below what your aircraft's handbook says. This is not a criticism. This is how skills work. They require currency. Every instrument pilot knows what happens to scan technique after a few months away from actual conditions. Crosswind landings are the same. The Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, or AOPA, recommends building personal minimums and actually writing them down, not keeping them vaguely in mind. Personal minimums are specific numbers you set during a period when you're current, rested, and thinking clearly. Not when you're standing on the ramp eager to fly on a day when everything else looks perfect. You decide what you're capable of when your judgment isn't being pulled by a nice afternoon and a full tank of fuel. A practical framework for crosswind minimums looks something like this. Ask yourself whether you've completed at least 3 takeoffs and landings in the last 30 days, with at least one of those involving a notable crosswind. If yes, your skills are probably reasonably current. If no, consider setting your personal crosswind ceiling a few knots lower until you get some practice in. Second consideration, the specific aircraft. If you're flying a tailwheel aircraft, crosswinds hit differently, the geometry is different, the technique is different, the consequences of drifting sideways on touchdown are more immediate. If you're relatively new to a tailwheel type or haven't flown it recently, treat your crosswind limits conservatively and consider getting some dual instruction before pushing the envelope. Third, look at the conditions surrounding the crosswind number itself. A steady 15-knot crosswind is a very different proposition than a gusting 12 to 22. Gusts compress the time you have to make corrections, they change your approach speed calculation, and they are significantly less forgiving of technique errors. The standard guidance for gusty conditions is to add half the gust factor to your approach speed. If winds are gusting 15 above the minimum reported value, add 7 to 8 knots to your target approach speed. Know those numbers before you get established on final. And know your go-around decision point, because on a gusty crosswind day, that threshold should probably be higher than it is on a calm afternoon. Give yourself the margin to make the call before you're committed. Let's spend a few minutes on technique, because how you fly a crosswind landing matters as much as the decision to attempt one. Most pilots are trained in the crab method, the wing low method, or some combination of both. In the crab method, you establish the aircraft pointed into the wind on final approach, correcting for drift, then kick the nose straight at or just before touchdown. In the wing low method, also called the slip, you use aileron into the wind combined with opposite rudder to keep the nose aligned with the runway throughout the approach. Most flight instructors prefer the wing low technique for light aircraft because it keeps you aligned with the center line throughout, reducing the risk of touching down with sideward drift, loading the landing gear laterally. Combining both methods works well in practice. Carry a crab on final to track the extended center line, then transition to wing low in the flare. The transition should be smooth and deliberate, not a last-second kick. The most common mistake is fixating on the nose and losing track of the center line. If you're drifting laterally at touchdown, the gear absorbs that load. In a typical crosswind landing, your upwind main gear touches first. The aircraft will tend to weather vane into the wind after main gear contact. Your job is to hold the nose straight with rudder and prevent the upwind wing from rising with aileron. And the work doesn't stop at touchdown. Crosswind control inputs actually need to increase as you decelerate, because control effectiveness decreases with airspeed. By the time you're approaching taxi speed, you should be holding full aileron into the wind. This prevents the upwind wing from getting lifted by any gust that hits while you're rolling out. We talk about the crosswind landing as if it's a single moment. It's a continuous process that begins when you enter the pattern and ends when you exit the active runway. Think of it as a sustained control loop, not a single event you survive. One more consideration that pilots often overlook: runway selection. If you're at a field with more than one runway option and the crosswind on runway 36 is at or near your personal limit, is a different runway available? Sometimes the math on an alternate runway changes the picture entirely. At non-towered airports, pilots can and should select the runway that best aligns with the actual wind. You're the pilot in command. At Towered Airports, don't hesitate to request a different runway. Controllers want to work with you. The request is routine, and the answer is usually yes. Here's what you need to know, bottom line. Your crosswind limit on any given day is a combination of three things: what the aircraft can handle, what your current skill level can handle, and what the actual conditions are asking of you. All three of those factors move. The clock method gives you a fast, reliable way to calculate what you're walking into. The 30-60-90 rule puts a real number in your head before you ever strap in. Compare that number to your handbook, to your personal minimums, and to an honest read of your recent currency. And if the number is close to your limit, give yourself permission to wait it out or fly another day. Crosswind landings are skills worth building, and you build them in a training environment with an instructor, not by surprise in conditions you weren't quite ready for. AOPA's Air Safety Institute has detailed crosswind training courses available at aop.org, and they're worth an afternoon if you haven't visited recently. This story originally ran on their news and training page. I'm Tower. Catch us at radiohanger.com. Stay sharp.